Illinois' pension reform law, now being challenged in the courts, is supposed to fix the state's pension shortfall. But how far does it go in fixing the state's overall budget deficit? That's the question asked by the Fiscal Futures Project of the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Their report came out today, and today on Focus, I'll talk with one of the report's authors, Richard Dye, about what's in the pension reform law and how it affects the bigger picture of state finances. Then Frank Shafroth of George Mason University talks about the troubles of other public pension funds around the country and what's been done to fix them. I'm Jim Meadows on Focus. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. A big part of Illinois' budget problems lie with its difficulty in paying into its public employee pension funds. And Illinois is not the only government in this situation. Later on the program, I'll be talking with Frank Shafroth at George Mason University's Center for State and Local Government Leadership about the pension burdens faced by several major cities and the various ways they're dealing with it. But first, we'll look at Illinois' pension situation here in Illinois through the lens of a new study issued today by the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs. The study looks at the new pension reform law passed late last year that aims to fix up Illinois' pension shortfall, and in doing so, fix up the state's overall budget deficit. How well does it do that? Well, for the findings of the study, we're talking to one of its authors, Professor Richard Dye at the U of I Chicago campus. Welcome to Focus, Richard.
Good morning, Jim.
And Richard, your report, it's released today, looks at the various measures in the new pension reform law. And while that law is being challenged in court and we're not quite sure what's going to happen to it, we're assuming for the sake of discussion that it's all constitutional and we can start implementing it right on schedule, which I think is in the middle of this year.
Correct.
Doing so, first of all, will it fix the pension shortfall itself?
It will. The time horizon is roughly 25 years to do so. A big savings up front, and then after 10 years or so, they start to pay that down more rapidly. And what's now a $100 billion unfunded liability will reach zero roughly 25 years from now.
Is a 25-year span to do this considered okay?
The normal guidance from the Government Accounting Standards Board is to spread out elimination of an unfunded liability over 30 years. So we're moving from being 90% funded in 50 years, well, actually only 40 of those years remain, but 95% funded in 50 years to 100% funded in 30 years, and then there's some extra payments that bring that 30 years down to 25.
And so when you're talking about what we're moving from, is that the pension reform measure that was passed in the 1990s under Governor Jim
That's
Edgar?
That's correct. That the scheduled payments under that 90s.
And that was a schedule that I understand the legislature and failed to keep up with.
Well, yeah, they failed to keep up with it. And it was also very, what you would say, backloaded. The payments actually starting about now, if that law was still in effect, would start to really pay things off. So there were a number of years where we were getting even farther behind. But yes, that's the 90s bill.
Well, before we go on to the next question, I want to welcome your questions about this subject. You can call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. And you can email your questions for Professor Dye to will-talk@illinois.edu. You can reach us on Twitter or Facebook at Focus580. Richard, we talked about how this law does with the pension shortfall, but of course also there are hopes that this would go some ways towards fixing the overall state budget deficit. And what's the verdict there?
A shorter time horizon is appropriate, I believe. And we look out 10 years, projecting the would-be deficit in a 900 funds budget instead of just the general funds budget to stop things being distorted by moving around. And it does very little over the next 10 years. Instead of the annual shortfall growing from, lost my numbers in front of me, but the annual shortfall growing from about $4 to $14 billion over the next 10 years, it's $1 billion less than that. It grows from $3 to $13 billion. You know, so we're shaving off what we have to pay for pensions, but we've still got a big catch up to do. So almost none of that. Well, of course, $1 billion is real money, but only $1 billion of that each year is going toward reducing the would-be payments of the state.
Okay, you mean that the state is still going to have to pay as much into pensions, or almost as much into pensions, over the next 10 years as it does now?
That's correct.
After that, what happens though?
After that, then it gets real good. You start to save, 2-5, and then when everything gets paid off, on the order of $15 billion a year. So looking out, it saves the state a lot of money, but it doesn't change the fact that something's got to give in the near term. We have to have some combination of higher taxes or lower payments for government services.
Now, if I remember correctly, during the entire discussion, and there was a lot of discussion over months and years about pension reform, but I remember some back and forth from various people in the debate over how much pension reform should pay into the pension as compared to save money for the state budget. And there were some people who were concerned about fixing the pension who really didn't want any of the savings that were created by these pension reform changes from going back to the general state budget.
Obviously, this was very contentious, both on the constitutional issue and the we were promised these benefits by the current workers and retirees. But the timing of any savings was a big issue. But the way it was resolved was to make the savings start 15 years from now, savings are 15 to 30 years from now.
And at the same time, the state is facing serious budget issues right now.
Serious budget issues, which they've struggled a lot and made big cuts and had this huge temporary tax increase over the last 4 years. Anybody who receives something from the state knows that the state has made cuts, but additional cuts are going to be on the horizon, whether done intentionally by planning, by recognition of the magnitude of the problem, or they're going to back into them because they, as they have for many of the cuts that are made in the last 4 years, they're going to back into them by just not having enough money and telling the governor, well, figure it out.
Well, I remember certainly, at the very least, I remember some Republican lawmakers saying at the time this was passed that essentially talking about pension reform as a good, as a good first start, as a good start, and that more would still have to be done on budget matters in addition to it. Were the lawmakers who were really the champions of this reform, as well as Governor Quinn, saying that this would solve the state's budget issues?
No, I don't think so. I think it was eyes open for certainly the people that were at the table. They're very savvy and aware of what the larger situation is. And the governor's budget office, for sure, is aware that there's these two problems: the annual flow, the mismatch between sustainable revenues and spending, and the accumulated debt to the system. So it was recognized by those who were sort of at the table But it was not well understood, or at least in my view, not well understood by people farther from it. And that's one of the reasons we timed our report, was to make that point. We've been measuring these structural deficits for a number of years now, but to make the point at a time when people might feel complacent that a big change has been made, problem solved, and move on. Certainly there's no reason to accuse any of the principal actors of disguising the dual nature of the problem. But I think others, both in the General Assembly and certainly in the public, might not understand how bad things really are.
Now, in the 1990s, with the pension reform measure there was a schedule for payment which was not kept to. Now that we're starting over again and trying to do it actually in less time, this does mean that the schedule, that the amount the state is paying in, is going to be larger, I take it.
No, it doesn't.
It doesn't.
The new pension law, I choke on the word reform, but the new pension law maintains payments into the system, as I said, about $1 billion less for the next 10 years, and then it ramps up. So they are paying less. The difference is that they have cut the costs of the system by cutting mostly the cost of living benefits that existing and future retirees had reason to expect. So the savings are from a shifting of what would have been a state responsibility under the old rules to less generous pension benefits for employees. What the state actually pays goes down slightly for 10 years, and then increasingly after that.
It goes down, and then it goes down even more.
That's
what
correct.
You're saying. It's not going to go up.
It's not going to go up.
So we have, if all of this again passes constitutional muster, we have what is a smaller pension program, and also a smaller amount that the state will be paying in for into it than they are now under the Edgar era plan.
Correct.
But it's still too much. To keep a balanced state budget without doing other things.
That's right.
Okay, so this is really a difficult state of affairs for I would gather if this law holds, but also if it doesn't hold, it is foreseeably even worse.
I don't understand the question in there, but
what I'm saying that if a court throws out some are part of this law, then the various elements which make possible a smaller pension payment for the state to disappear.
That's correct, and it will be worse if they're. This could be in the courts for a long time, but if in 2 or 3 years the court says no, you're not entitled to those savings, it violates a constitutional guarantee of contract with the retirees. Then any that $1 billion for each of the next several years that I was talking about will make the state that much farther behind on the pension debt.
We are talking about this new study from the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs, looking at the fiscal details of the pension reform law and how it affects the state budget in the next decade or so. And one of the authors of the report is my guest, Richard Dye, who says it doesn't do enough. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. 1-800-222-WILL. Our email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Twitter and Facebook and Focus 580. Let's take a call now on line one. David in Urbana, good morning. You're on Focus.
Hello. Yes. I'd simply like to make two comments. The first is historical parallel. back at the end of the 13th century, Edward I found that he was having financial difficulties. He'd fought several very expensive wars, and the treasury was empty. So he went to Italy, and he borrowed money from a Florentine banking family. And when the money came due, he said, "Sorry, I don't have the money." And he borrowed from another Florentine banking family and repeated the process. He then tried to borrow from the Medici, who told him, "We don't think your credit rating's very good." So he went home and he found another solution. He extorted money, in fact, all of the wealth of the English Jews, who I might point out had been in England longer than Edward's ancestors by about 1,000 years. In fact, had been there longer than the Anglo-Saxons. They came about the first century B.C. It seems to me that what the state has done is very similar to this. They've essentially borrowed money from the state employees and then said, "No, sorry, we can't pay you what we said we were going to." The other thing I would like to point out is if there had been no pension and we had been given Social Security, which we were denied, the state would have had to have paid this money. Care to comment?
There's probably a number of historical analogies, but yes, it is easy to find blame in the actions of the state, the General Assembly, and the governor, for buying labor services that they paid for partly with IOUs to be redeemed later, in the form of pension promises, where they didn't put aside anything to fund those promises, and then when those promises came due or start to be looked at as much more realistic as coming due, they said, "Gosh, we don't have the money." That is true. Social Security. Anybody, if you're looking at somebody else framing this issue that, "Oh, gee, the state pensioners are overpaid," I don't think that's the case. And indeed, the public school employees and the university employees in Illinois don't get Social Security. And yes, if you're looking at them as getting a good pension, it's not true because they're not getting Social Security. But none of that historical blame, analogies that sharpen the historical blame or anything, changes the fact that here we are in a fiscal mess, which the taxpayers, not the past members of the legislature, the taxpayers or service or pension recipients or recipients of other services of the state are going to have to pay for. I agree with you, but here we are.
John, thank you very much for the call. I'd like to go over to I was going to go over to line four, but we seem to have lost that caller. But I understand from the notes my producer passed me that that the caller was asking about a comparison with this new pension reform law and the old one. Since really the old pension law was a law, and yet the legislature failed to make the payments on schedule, why are we going to think this is going to be any different, even to the degree of what it dictates?
The old pension law is two things. It is a set of formula-based payments for the recipients, for the people who work for the government, and it's also the employee pays in so much, and the employer pays in so much. The new law, and I'm not as much an expert on all the details of the new law, but the new law does have some additional guarantees that the old law didn't. There really wasn't any. They said it's a constitutional and contractual guarantee, but they didn't say that the state had to make any schedule payments. That was a continuing resolution, a separate law that said, here's our timetable for making those payments. So there's the pension law, multiple laws really, because there's different funds, but there's the pension law, and then there's the pension funding, multiple year appropriation. There's reason to be concerned going forward about future legislatures and governors reneging, but I think, and the new law is purported to have guarantees, some guarantees against that.
My understanding with the new law is that it allows the trust, the boards of the various pension funds, to sue the state.
Correct.
If they don't see enough funding from the legislature coming in, by the schedule that the law sets down.
Yeah.
Do you think that will work?
I'm aware of that provision. It does have more teeth, and there were certainly people at the table when this was hammered out that had the interests of the Public Employees Union in heart. I believe so, but again, I'm not an expert on law. I'm an economist.
Okay. Well, we're talking about the new pension law does and how it affects the overall state budget. Your report uses the phrase structural deficit. Are in the opening line, Illinois has a chronic structural fiscal problem so huge that it cannot be eliminated by increases in economic growth alone, increases in taxes alone, or, alas, aggressive pension changes alone. I wanted to ask you about the word structural, because I've heard that, unfortunately, many times in referring to the Illinois state budget over the last few years. When we talk about a structural deficit, what exactly does that mean?
Well, it isn't consistently defined, for all people who use it. But I will certainly tell you what we mean when we do it. When we look out 10 years, the state doesn't project out 10 years. They only recently started projecting out 3 years, and really all that is a general funds revenue projection for 3 years, and then they do some fill in for what would happen to have to happen to spending. What we do is we project revenues, but ignore two key sources of revenue that legally count for balancing the budget, but aren't sustainable, and that is spending down of pre-existing fund account balances and new borrowing. So we take those out of the revenue calculations, and then we do the same thing on the revenue and spending side. We project forward 10 years based on historical growth rates of the different spending categories and revenue categories. And we say, if those trends hold, here's where we'll be in 2, 4, 10 years. The focus on sustainable revenues, the focus on a longer-term perspective, and projecting out the trend rates of growth of a number of key revenue sources and a number of spending categories. So what I say mismatch when we project out those revenues, taking out the one-time sources that aren't sustainable, when we project out, we have this mismatch, this gap, which I call a structural gap, a structural deficit, between sustainable revenues and would-be spending.
Okay, so just the way things are set up now, and if nothing changes, the state cannot help but be in the red.
Well, not help. I mean, they can.
But they have to do something.
They have to do something to avoid this. That's the message from what this calculation intends.
Okay, so if we stick with the status quo about the way the state is spending money now, and the way that the state is taking in money now, and factor in what's happening with the new pension law, then red ink is the answer.
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking at historical data for revenues in the past. I'm looking at official projections of the spending on pensions and also for debt service, and then our own projections out in the future. So something has to give. The state has to spend more. Spend less, tax more, or do some form of borrowing, of time shifting, which is the type of stuff that's gotten us into that mess. So either explicit borrowing, more of the implicit or hidden borrowing, like making pension promises but not planning for financing them, or the other type of borrowing that has been really noticed in the last 5 years is unpaid bills. So somehow, if there's a mismatch, you've got to either respond to it or push the payment out into the future.
And I assume the Florentines and the Medici are no longer available to the state of Illinois, but just further borrowing, is there a wise way to structure borrowing to make it part of the equation?
Well, a number of instances, Governor Quinn has said, let's borrow a little bit to pay for these unpaid bills. And others, this kind of skepticism injected by some of your callers, others said, but wait a minute, is that going to do anything to change the underlying imbalance? What others have said is those on both sides of the aisle who recognize this mismatch is if there is a plan for what to do with revenue increases for how many years, for which programs to cut in which pattern in which time, and transitional borrowing to get us on track so that we're not getting farther into the red, but that the lines cross or converge sometime in the future. If there was a plan, what is that plan? How do you enforce that plan with people with different political stripes? That's the hard part. But without a plan, there really is no appropriate way to borrow for operations. Borrowing for buying big, real physical capital projects it makes economic sense. But borrowing for operations doesn't, because it just time shifts the burden.
Well, let's hear a plan. I think our next caller may have something to say about this. Paul in Champaign County on line two. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi, thank you. The Center for Tax and Budget Accountability and Ralph Mature, who's been on the show before, has a proposal, and he says that it's the flawed tax policy that's the primary driver of Illinois' current funding deficit, and that contrary to the propaganda, he tried to write letters when the discussion about the raising of the income tax a while back went on, and the constant characterization of Illinois as a high tax state. For an industrial state, it is not a high tax state. We pushed ahead of Illinois by a little bit when the income tax. So putting it on the burden on the retirees who have a contract, and I'm one of them, just for the sake of argument, it's absolutely wrong. It's absolutely wrong, and there's so much distortion it isn't a hard solution if we really had the people represented and if people didn't believe that, for one, Illinois is a high tax state. It's not.
And so you're saying that taxes can go up, or perhaps we can go to the proposal that's been out there for a while of a progressive tax structure instead of the flat.
Surely. Now, there are things to do even before that. Which that demands a constitutional amendment of some sort or another. But there are things that can be done to actually. And the gentleman here says that even if we raise taxes, we can't get out of it. I don't think that's true. And I think
Richard, did you say that raising taxes would not be a solution?
I said that given the current state, and avoiding myself talking about the blame part of it, given the current state, there is going to have to be some combination of tax increases, spending cuts, and maybe transitional borrowing.
So you think there's no one solution but a combination?
We've calculated what economic growth brings in revenues, and that's not enough. We've calculated what the deficit would be if the existing higher income tax rate was in place, and that's not enough. We started this whole program talking about what about the new pension payment schedule for the state. That's not enough. The state is still in a structural mess. So it is possible then for somebody to come up with a tax increase plan, and that's what the caller is describing, that would help us out of this situation. But there needs to be a political constituency for that that would get this passed. I could solve the problem. The particular tax increase that the proposal that you're talking about could solve the problem, but it needs to get voted in, and that's the difficulty.
That's the question right now. Of course, as we know, the tax increase, which was voted in by the legislature about a year or so, a couple of years ago, is now coming up for expiration, and it's really no guarantee that that it's going to be extended. Certainly a lot of people would like to, especially on the Republican side, but I suspect other places as well would like to see that tax increase go away. But if it goes away, that's additional difficulty for the state.
Yeah, that's the base. But that was in the base. It going away, which is current law, was in that baseline of a $4 billion structural gap.
So what you're looking at, you're assuming the tax increase goes away.
That's correct.
What if it doesn't go away?
If it doesn't go away, that solves about half the structural deficit problem.
About half, and that leaves us about how much?
Well, look out 10 years. We go from 14 to 7, and then if we have the pension laws passing muster on top of that, the 7 goes down to 6. So it's together, they make a huge dent, but they're still not enough.
And what if lawmakers and voters were to amend the state constitution, allowing for a progressive tax or a more progressive tax? Would that come up with the sort of revenue enhancements that would go all the way, or would you still have to go look at the other means?
Well, there's two questions there. You stipulated that there would be constitutional approval, but then you have to say, well, what progressive rate structure? Certainly, there is a progressive rate structure that would raise all the revenues we need to pay promised pension benefits and everything else. But it's the two-step on that, both of which are political. I think it is naive to believe that it would ever pass partly because of this trust, not just because of the liberal conservative redistributional sort of politics, but because of this mistrust. The government has in Illinois has not been a good steward of our money, and we're going to trust them with a much more open-ended tax increase is a very difficult step. And then, if they had that power, they would still have to pass some sort of a tax increase. So it's the two political steps, not the arithmetic of that there is some tax that would do it.
Is that part of the reason why you're saying that it will take a mix of approaches?
I'm agnostic. I mean, as an individual voter, I'm, I could solve the problem myself. I would raise taxes on you and cut your programs and keep mine, but I'm agnostic as to whether it happens in the form of tax increases or spending cuts, but it has to be large tax increases or large spending cuts, and the largeness. So there is a political coloring to my reasoning here. The largeness of either of those suggests to me that it has to be some combination of both. But that's just, you know, that's just speculation. The arithmetic is there.
Okay. Well, Richard Dime, we're going to have to go now. We're about to talk to somebody who can tell us about even more problems with more pension funds.
Okay.
But thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me. The Institute of Government and Public Affairs Fiscal Futures Project report can be found on their website at igpa.uillinois.edu. And as soon as we can, we'll attach it to our website at will.illinois.edu. Richard Dye, thank you for being on Focus.
Great to talk with you and your listeners.
This is Focus on WILL. We're back on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. The subject is public pensions. We spent the first part of the program looking at Illinois' pension funds and the new pension reform law meant to fix it, and a report that says that while the pension reform law will fix the pension system eventually, it will not, at least in the next 10 years, be enough to fix Illinois' larger deficit problems. But Illinois is not the only state having problems with its budget and with its pensions, and I wanted to look at some of the other problem places around the country with Frank Shafroth. He is the director at George Mason University's Center for State and Local Government Leadership, and he's looked at the problems that many municipal pension funds have gotten themselves into. Frank, welcome to Focus.
Thank you very much. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And very quickly, we could take a call or two during the time we have left at 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL, email at will-talk@illinois.edu. If you have some questions about these are cases you were looking at municipal pensions, I understand.
Yes, really looking. Last year, I spent a long time looking at six major cities and really looking at their physical condition, what happened. It began really with going up to Providence, Rhode Island, and visiting Central Falls when it was in bankruptcy, a big portion of the issue being pensions to employees and retirees in Central Falls, a very small town or city, almost walking distance from Providence, Rhode Island. So that's when it first hit me how significant an issue public pension obligations are and the implications in the health of cities and counties in the United States.
Besides Central Falls, you found other cities I take it several other cities that are facing problems to some degree or another.
The big places we're really looking at right now are pension situations, which could end up in the United States Supreme Court. And I'm speaking specifically here of Detroit, obviously in Michigan, and San Bernardino, and Southern California.
I have also heard about problems with Chicago's pensions, of there being a deficit there. Do you know anything about that city's situation?
Chicago has a significant pension issue. It's city of Chicago. The Windy City faces a $590 million increase in its required pension contribution for the next fiscal year, which at least one expert describes as a rise so sharp it would require a significant increase in the city of Chicago's property tax levy and crippling cuts to Chicago's services to its citizens or some combination.
And at the same time, as bad as that sounds, I take it you're saying certainly in the case of Detroit, since they've already filed for bankruptcy, other cities are in worse shape than Chicago.
Yes, no doubt about it. Right now we have, as I said, the two biggest cases that are in bankruptcy are Detroit, where pensions are very much at the heart of the bankruptcy there. San Bernardino, same thing. Pensions are very much at the heart of it there. Both California and Michigan, it's complicated further by their state constitutional protections, which makes resolving them something challenging and something which, as I said, could end up going all the way to the United States Supreme Court for resolution.
When we look at these cities with troubled pension funds, is there any common thread of how they got into this big pickle?
I would say there are a number of common threads, which would include the terrible thing that all of your listeners and I are getting older. And not just getting older, but we're living a lot longer than previous generations. So I looked at a trend line going from 1955 to last year, the number of active people versus beneficiaries, and that ratio has changed by better than a 3-to-1 margin. So, for instance, in 1955, there were an awful lot of state and local workers paying into pension systems and not so many retirees. You've seen nearly a 300% change by the end of 2010. So now there are a lot fewer, especially in the wake of the Great Recession, employees supporting a much larger number of retirees.
I think you emailed us. That's the graph that you emailed
us. That's the graph I sent you, yes.
And, of course, graphs do not make for great radio, but I am going to ask about, because I can't quite see the dates on this, there's one period where the fall is especially steep. Can you tell me?
1970 to 1980 is the steep drop.
And that's when things really got bad quickly, and then they continued to get bad at a steady rate, but not quite as quickly.
Right.
What happened in the 1970s?
The 70s, you had a recession, particularly around 1974, so you began to see what I would call the first big slimming down by states and local governments, reducing the number of employees. You begin to see technology coming in and taking the place of state and local human beings. So you saw that reduction of, in effect, people paying into the retirement system, and likewise an increase in the number of people retiring. So that ratio changed and began the big slide that you see overall there.
Things got a little better, or that is to say that they got worse at a slower rate after that.
Yes, that's right.
In terms of, you know, how many people are benefiting from pension systems and how many people are around to pay into it as people who are working. And now I'm wondering, as we're constantly told that people of my generation, the baby boomers, are getting ready to retire at a great rate, do we expect to see things shift again?
Yes, we now face that second thing. The peak of retirement was 1957, and now we're entering a different sort of stretch beginning this year, which is 10 years from where we have the peak of Americans who are working now 10 years from retirement. So the second related part is this really good news for your listeners, but mixed in terms of the topic we're discussing, which is that now boomers are going to, on average, men will live 11 years longer than previous generations of Americans, and women will live 12 years longer. So the plans under which we had Medicare and Social Security nationally and state and local pension systems didn't anticipate this significant change in longevity. So you paid in assuming people were going to, on average, die much younger than it turns out they're going to. You can imagine what that does in terms of throwing off calculations.
So that looks for a greater strain ahead for these pension systems.
That's right.
I gather there are some cities which have done better than others as far as handling their pension funds. Do you see some success stories?
Well, you see, an effort underway in San Jose, California, will face a stiff challenge. Cities that have very good credit ratings have generally shown an ability to take this issue on. But it's complicated in this way. It's complicated, as I said, say, in California, Michigan, and a number of states, because the state constitution defines a pension as a contract and protects that contract so it can't be changed.
The Illinois Constitution has the same language.
Yes.
Have any cases in those states, have those states had any cases come up that judges had to rule on as far as public pensions are concerned? And that
I think the big ruling is coming down the road. And I say that because we've now got, in both the case of San Bernardino and the case of Detroit, appeals by the unions and retirees of the bankruptcy decisions, which hinge in part on the respective state constitutions. So this is an issue potentially that's going to go before the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals based in Cincinnati and the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in California, and could end up being appealed to the United States Supreme Court. The issue there is, can a federal bankruptcy law trump a state constitution? So it's unprecedented. But that might be the only way to deal with the pension obligations of the city of Detroit and the city of San Bernardino. So I think, you know, coming to a court near us in the not too distant future, this might be determined by 9 justices on the Supreme Court.
Can a state, obviously states can declare bankruptcy, because we seem to be seeing this with the city of Detroit. I mean,
well,
cities can do that. Can states do it?
There's not a can or cannot. We only have one time in American history when a state has been insolvent or bankrupt, and that was Arkansas in 1837. And Arkansas got in trouble because that was another period of great recession across the country. And Arkansas went insolvent in its efforts to help, in effect, help 37 cities in Arkansas. We've never had anything very close to it since, although obviously people are quite worried about the state of Illinois, and that marks part of the urgency and efforts in the Illinois legislature and by the governor to try and turn around its pension.
And you're saying that the Arkansas insolvency attempt was to help strapped cities in the
That's
state
right.
at the time. Well, that raises the question here in Illinois with the problems it already has. Could the problems with the Chicago pension system have ripples that affect the state as a whole?
Well, Chicago is really the economic engine for the state of Illinois. So if Chicago and Cook County really got in trouble, it would undoubtedly have significant implications. It would be close to a tidal wave that would impact the state of Illinois. So the health, particularly, I guess you describe it, if I think about, most of us when we think about Chicago think about the river, the canals underneath the city, the L, but there's a separate part which is what you and I are talking about now, and that's its what I would call its human infrastructure and its physical infrastructure, and if that falls apart, it would be devastating for the city's economy, and that would in turn have very adverse impacts on the entire state of Illinois.
I want to apologize for our caller on the line. I don't think we're going to have time in this final minute to take your call, but he is expressing his irritation, if that's the right word,
mm-hmm.
because he's looking at his age where he is and when he's going to be able to retire, and he doesn't, and he may have to keep on working into his 70s, this the way that he sees it. We seem to be just in a new and pretty unsettling place as far as what's going to happen with these pension funds and with government debt.
Yes, it's very hard. It's hard because a lot of voters and taxpayers look for what you might call instant gratification. They want to know what's in the budget for next year for schools, for police, for parks, for all the things that they can see immediately, and it's hard to see. Therefore, it makes it harder for elected officials at the state or local level to say, you know, instead of building that new school or making it as nice as you might want it, we're going to take a greater portion and put it towards our pension obligations, in part because those obligations have increased for some of the reasons you and I have been discussing, that workers are living a lot longer than we projected. So there's that political dimension. If someone wants to run for mayor of Chicago and says, vote for me because I'm going to take a lot more of your taxes and put it into pensions for employees and retirees of the city of Chicago, and another one says, vote for me and I'm going to put a lot more into schools and to public safety, I'm sure your listeners understand the latter candidate is probably likely to get more votes. So it takes greater courage and discipline to make the hard choices about honoring public pension obligations.
Well, not exactly a satisfying place to close the conversation, but that seems to be where things are now. And I want to say thank you, Frank Shafroth of the Center for State and Local Government Leadership at George Mason University in Virginia, here on Focus on WYLL.